Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the outrageous voter suppression bill Georgia's governor signed into law at the same time having a Georgia state legislator arrested for knocking on the door to witness the secret signing. An expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting, Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles, joins us to discuss how the focus on making it a crime to hand out water to voters waiting in long lines misses the point that there should not be long lines in the first place. We also look into how this bill and others Republicans are pushing through state legislatures takes away the power to count and certify votes from elected secretaries of state and puts tallying the vote in the hands of partisan Republican politicians, many of whom were leaned on by Trump in the last election not to certify Biden's victory, while others who acted with decency and fairness now find themselves under attack from Trump's GOP. Then we look into the road not taken in ending World War I in 1916, which would have spared millions of lives wasted in a brutal stalemate and perhaps prevented the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and later the rise of Hitler. Philip Zelikow, professor of history and governance at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, who was executive director of the 9/11 Commission and who worked on international policy in each of five administrations from Reagan through Obama, joins us to discuss his new book just out, The Road Less Traveled, The Secret Battle to End the Great War, 1916 to 1917. We discuss the importance of diplomacy in both preventing wars and ending them. Then finally, we'll discuss how Biden can quickly phase out coal-fired power plants and work with key senators in coal country like Joe Manchin to create high-paying union jobs to switch to wind and solar without burdening the taxpayer. Robert Bell, former chair of the Finance and Business Management Department at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York, joins us from Paris to discuss his latest article at Le Monde, Joe Biden's 100 Days. How big will energy transformation policy be? And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola University School of Law in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting. And his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the United States Supreme Court. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Levitt.
Thank you very much, Ian. Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And voter suppression is underway in the most brazen way, particularly in Georgia. What do you think can be done to challenge these laws? I mean, President Biden has described what's happening across the country as being sick, and he has reiterated the idea that in Georgia they've criminalized handing out water to voters in these long lines. To my mind, actually, that misses the point. We shouldn't have long lines in the first place, should we?
Well, the interesting thing about the Georgia bill is there are some things it does that I actually think are fairly good. There are some things it does that I think are fairly horrible. And there are some things that it does that I think are, in the president's words, sick. I agree with him on that. Among the things that it does that I think of as fairly good are there is a provision that would seek to limit the length of time that anyone has to wait to vote in Georgia. It's too slow and too ineffective, but it essentially says if you've had lines longer than an hour long, you have to get your ship in shape. And that, frankly, is it's a little too little in terms of medicine, but that's welcome. Some of the very other things in the law, of course, help to ensure that the lines are likely to be longer than they've been in the past, including severe cutbacks on absentee voting, severe cutbacks on the amount of time that counties have available to offer individuals to vote. And then there are some provisions that are, as mentioned, sick. The prohibition on giving food or water to people who happen to be waiting in line has no legitimate purpose that I can tell. It is simply there to make people exercising the franchise uncomfortable. And that's grotesque. That's something that we should be long past in this country. And unfortunately, we're not. The reason that legislators thought it was okay to put that provision into the law is that not every Georgia voter is waiting online for multiple hours. Lines congregate in more crowded jurisdictions and don't happen a lot in rural jurisdictions. If every voter had to wait in lines that were more than 3 hours long, there's no way that the legislature would have put that provision into place. It is only because that only impacts some people and not people that the legislature is currently fond of that provision made it into the law at all. But that's disgraceful. Election laws and regulations should be used to make sure that eligible people vote and ineligible people don't. They shouldn't be used to drive the nature of the electorate or the comfort of the electorate. And the fact that Georgia politicians are abusing their power in this regard is disgusting.
But isn't it pretty clear that across the board in many states, there aren't long lines in largely white rural communities, whereas there always seem to be long lines in urban minority communities?
It's certainly true that where the lines happen, they tend to be in urban minority communities. I will say there are jurisdictions that have not always and all the time, but have managed to take steps to decrease the likelihood of lines, even in urban minority communities. We can do it if we work at it. Los Angeles is one of those, actually. And that progress was not always uniform or effective across the board. So Los Angeles took some steps, including a redesign of sign-in systems, a redesign of systems where you vote, expansion of the capacity to vote by mail, the addition of drop boxes. California in general, and Los Angeles in particular, did an awful lot to try and serve their voters because California is not scared of its voters. And Los Angeles isn't scared of its voters in the way that Georgia sure seems to be. That didn't work perfectly in the first election in which this was rolled out, was the spring election, the March election 2020, just before the pandemic hit for real in Los Angeles County. And despite the registrar's best efforts, there were significant lines at just a few polling places in Los Angeles. Most of them worked quite smoothly, a few of them really did not. But good election administrators and good election officials learn from those experiences and tweak in order to better serve their constituents the next time around, which is exactly what happened again in Los Angeles. So I don't think it's inevitable that urban, largely minority communities will encounter heinous lines. I think it's a product of underfunding of local jurisdictions, and occasionally interference, usually by state officials, with what's necessary to provide good customer service.
But back to Georgia, though, although not criminalizing giving out water and food to people waiting in long lines is getting a lot of attention in this sweeping bill that's just passed in Georgia and signed by the governor, who signed it in secret. And one of the legislators in the Georgia State House knocked on the door and got arrested.
Yeah, he actually signed it in front of, it's surrounded by an entirely white cast of legislators, and
Right.
in front of a picture depicting a relatively infamous slave plantation. And it's hard to see that as mistake or coincidence.
And indeed, this prompted Stacey Abrams to say, as the FBI continued to round up seditionists who spilled blood to defend a lie about our elections, Republican state leaders willfully undermine democracy by giving themselves authority to overturn results that they do not like. Now more than ever, Americans must demand federal action to protect voting rights as we continue to fight against these blatantly unconstitutional efforts that are nothing less than Jim Crow 2.0. I mean, that's the point, isn't it, Justin? That what they've done in Georgia is take away the ability to count votes and to certify elections from the Secretary of State, who did the right thing and has been vilified for it by both the president and by presumably by local Republican leaders. Now, essentially, partisan Republican lawmakers get to count and certify the votes.
They did two things. They sharply limited the power of the Secretary of State, which, yeah, as you've pointed out, there have been a lot of things that past Georgia Secretaries of State have done that I've disagreed with. There have even been some things that this present Georgia Secretary of State have done that I disagreed with. But one thing that I would hope all Americans can agree on is that Brad Raffensperger, a conservative Republican by any measure, did a remarkable job in staving off enormous pressure in order to deliver the result that actually fit what the voters of Georgia had decided. That is, he ran an election that was audited and re-audited and certified and recertified in a way that simply involved adding up the votes that he should have added up. And while that shouldn't normally come in for heroism, given the pressure he was on to do precisely the opposite, actually makes him a bit of a hero in these past elections. So Georgia responded by taking the power away from him. It's actually even more significant that they've taken the power away from local boards of elections, from the county officials who are closest to their voters, and allowed a state board, a newly constituted state board that would be put in place with partisan picks of the legislature, to essentially take over local elections. And I will be shocked if that provision is used to take over local elections in a fair and non-discriminatory way across the state. I suspect that it will be used, or I fear that it would be used, to create real state mischief in areas like Fulton County, where Atlanta sits, or where large parts of Atlanta sits, and DeKalb County, where more of Atlanta sits. I suspect it'll be used to take over counties that are responding to their local constituents in ways that the state legislators do not like. And that is dangerous. The notion that election administration should be driven by which voters are responding to a particular election is really troubling. And that's even more troubling than taking the position away from a partisan Secretary of State position that just so happened to be in the hands of a partisan who acted quite admirably in November of 2020.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He's an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting, and his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the United States Supreme Court. Well, in the last election, we had the example in Michigan where just one vote by a decent Republican on the board that certified the election made the difference. And what had happened is that Trump had personally intervened with the Republican Party in Michigan, and obviously one of the people on the board voted in Trump's favor without any evidence, of course, against Biden's victory. But fortunately, the other guy on the board of four voted with the two Democrats. And otherwise, Trump would have been able to, well, I don't know whether he could have overturned the Michigan results, but he certainly would have stymied them. And again, it comes down, Justin, it comes down to the character of the kind of people that are tasked with certifying elections.
Yes. And in that regard, I am immensely heartened by the fact that there were across the board at every level, local, state, and federal, there were enough people of character in positions of power, tasked with, as you say, tallying and certifying elections, who did the right thing regardless of party and regardless of personal preference. Our election system has always depended on good faith at some level. You cannot run a government, you cannot elect a government if you do not have officials of good faith who are acting in good faith. Last election, there were far more officials of good faith who did their jobs, who ran the elections as the law required, who counted the votes that were cast, who certified the tallies of those counts in ways that just reflected reality rather than reflecting a personal preference or a partisan preference. And we should all, as we should every year, be grateful to them for that. The scary thing is that there were far too many officials who did not see that as part of their role or their mandate. There were a few local officials who did not do their jobs. There were a few state officials who did not do their jobs. There were a few members of Congress who did not do their jobs. And the notion that they thought they had permission to not do their jobs is really, really disturbing. Again, the system held, the institutions held, because there were more people of neutral goodwill who were just focused on certifying the vote as the facts required. And we should all be grateful for that. But the fact is, that was far too close a call.
So going forward now, three voting rights groups have already challenged the Georgia law. There's also a lot of talk that maybe the brazen and outrageous nature of what they've done in Georgia and prior to that, what they've done in Iowa might actually give impetus to the Democrats being able to find a way to pass HR1, SB1, the For the People Act, which would federalize the entire system and get rid of these mendacity at the state level.
One correction there, actually. The For the People Act is really important, and I agree that part of the egregious nature of the new Georgia bill, certainly it makes the political lift on the For the People Act a lot easier. Because if you want to spur federal regulation, the more states you have acting badly, and Georgia is acting badly right now. The more emphasis there will be behind the federal need for regulation. But it's not, the For the People Act is not actually a federal takeover. That's been the call by some in the election community is for a federal takeover. It's certainly been the talking point that I've heard used, but it's not actually true. What the For the People Act would do is set a federal floor, but it would not federalize elections. It would leave states in control. It would allow lots of flexibility to state actors. And I think that's a good thing. I don't want the same system in California that the voters of Alabama might want for themselves. But I do want there to be a federal floor so that at least we have a baseline of consistency, of real customer service that every voter in the country can depend on, regardless of where they live. And I think the difference between those two things is important. I have real concerns about a true federal takeover. If the federal government ran the election process, I think we might have had a very different story coming out of 2020. I just mentioned that the government and the election process depends on people of goodwill, and I'm not convinced that it would have gone anywhere near as smoothly with a truly federalized election process in 2020. But having a federal floor that states administer but can't fall below is a really important safeguard. And I think something that people ought to be able to appreciate as different from a takeover and very much different from the sort of nonsense we have now, where Georgia can enact the sorts of bills that it has in the past few days.
So just in closing, though, how do you deal with the fact that so many people in this country, those that watch Fox News and listen to the president, those that contributed to his Stop the Steal, apparently he's made up to a $500 million or even more out of that. And now he's rewriting history about what happened on January the 6th in an interview with Fox News' Laura Ingraham. Trump said it was about what happened on January the 6th on the Capitol. It was zero threat right from the start. It was zero threat. Look, they went in. They shouldn't have done it. Some of them went in and they are hugging and kissing the police and the guards, you know. They had great relationships. A lot of people were waved in and then they walked in and they walked out. So I don't know whether you can hold Rupert Murdoch to account for altering the reality in so many minds of Americans. Of course, it hurts Biden enormously to have a big constituent in this country feeling he's not even a legitimate president. And that's clearly the intention of the Republicans. But, I mean, Biden himself in his first press conference said that he's talking to Republican voters who agree with him that this situation is sick and not the Republican professional politicians. Is there a way to sort of drive a wedge between Republican voters and Republican politicians?
There is, and that is responding to what people actually want. I think I have abiding faith in the American people to think for themselves. It depends on good information. It depends on a little bit of self-discipline. It depends on people being careful about the information that they receive and spread. But ultimately, people make choices, and they're pretty conscious of the choices they're making most of the time when they do so. There are a few people who have, unfortunately, fallen deep down the well of an online cult, but those are, and it's a disturbing number of people, but still relatively few. That doesn't speak to the American people as a whole, no matter what policy priorities people may have, no matter what political preferences they may have. Politicians are only able to take advantage of the public when the public doesn't actually realize what's going on. And by speaking to some of the issues that real Americans actually care about, wage security, getting through the pandemic, making sure there's a job waiting on the other side of the pandemic, making sure that the country is secure, making sure that we're not engaged in conflicts overseas that we shouldn't be engaged in, sorts of things that people actually really care about, then that provides a window to open people's eyes to reality. And when people's eyes are open to reality, they can see for themselves whether the sun is shining outside or whether it's cloudy or raining. The fact that the president wants to rewrite history or create an alternate history doesn't mean that we have to listen to him. We all know what we saw. We all know what we heard. We all know what actually happened at the Capitol on January 6th. It was not loving and kissing and peaceful and quiet. It was a mob taking over the seat of government for the first time domestically in our country's history. The only other time that's happened at all was when the British invaded in the War of 1812. There were more than 140 Capitol Police officers who were injured. There were five people killed, including a member of the Capitol Police. There were police who were beaten by flagpoles and fire extinguishers and who were tear gassed at the time, crushed in doorways. And that footage is still available widely for anyone who cares to understand what reality is. So I think the way to speak to the American people and to coax them back into an arena where they feel comfortable engaging with reality is to take care of job one, which is doing the people's business, and without a lot of bluster and without a lot of fanfare and without a lot of showmanship, to get policy done that people appreciate. I think that's been President Biden's goal. I think that's been his operating mode since starting this administration, and I would expect that to continue.
Well, Justin Levitt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Of course. Pleasure to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Justin Levitt, professor of law at Loyola University Law School in Los Angeles. He is an expert on election law who focuses particularly on election administration and redistricting, and his work has been cited extensively in the media and in the courts, including by the United States Supreme Court. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the road not taking and ending World War I in 1916, which would have spared millions of lives wasted in a brutal stalemate and perhaps prevented the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and later the rise of Hitler.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Philip Zelikow, who's the White Birkett Miller Professor of History and the J. Wilson Newman Professor of Governance at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. A former career diplomat, he was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, and he worked on international policy in each of the five administrations from Reagan through Obama, and is the author of the new book just out, The Road Less Traveled, The Secret Battle to End the Great War, 1916 to 1917. Welcome to Background Briefing, Philip Zelikow.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And before we get into talking about this new history that you've revealed, detailed accounts of the secret peace negotiations among the warring parties in World War I from the autumn of 1916 to the spring of 1917, let me ask you just a little about, since you were the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, it doesn't look like we're going to stand up a similar commission on what happened on the Capitol on January the 6th. At least you had some bipartisanship back then. There's precious little now. You've got, what, three Republican senators that may go along with the Democrats. And I think the trajectory in terms of bipartisanship becoming more and more impossible is pretty clear as long as Donald Trump controls the GOP. So what's your reading on whether anything's going to happen in terms of a bipartisan commission looking into the assault on the Capitol on January the 6th?
I think it looks pretty bad right now. There are two problems. One of the problems in the Congress that you mentioned, and right now the Democrats are proceeding with congressional investigations rather than relying on a commission. The other problem is all the ongoing criminal cases, which create some complications for people trying to mount a commission because they could kind of overlap and cross with the ongoing hundreds of criminal trials that may not run their course until next year. So I think right now, Congress is moving ahead without the commission, and that commission idea looks bad. The interesting commission idea to me that I think really cries out for nonpartisan treatment, is the COVID crisis. I think there ought to be, and I'm currently involved with others working on a national COVID commission to do a deep examination of what happened and why I think the most impactful crisis to hit the United States since 1945.
Well, would that attract bipartisan or nonpartisan participation given?
I think it can. I think it can because each side, of course, has narratives that focus on what Trump did or what Trump didn't do. That's very important. But I think people who look really hard at the crisis and who know a lot about it know that the issues are much, much bigger than that. This is a crisis that's shown an X-ray into every fault line of the American healthcare system, from the point of origin of this crisis, even to the challenges we have now to get reliable testing and data. There are a lot of issues here that don't fall into neat partisan categories and that really demand that United States and the world learn how to adapt better to such an existential challenge to humanity.
And of course, we do have another challenge, and it is in the context of your new book, Philip Zelikow, The Road Less Traveled, The Secret Battle to End the Great War, 1916 to 1917. How do you see Chinese incremental pressure on Taiwan in the context of your book? Because it looks more to me like Barbara Tuchman's The Guns of August. You've got the Chinese Air Force making more and more incursions daily into Taiwan's airspace. They just made a much bigger one in the southern part of the island. Do you think that things could get out of control between the United States and China?
Actually, I'm worried about that. Your listeners may not be aware of this, but along with an old colleague named Bob Blackwell, I recently co-authored a special report of the Council on Foreign Relations on the Taiwan crisis, along with an essay in a place called War on the Rocks on how to avoid a war with Taiwan. And partly we argue for different ways to deter a conflict that rely more on political and economic measures and not as much on forward military defense. So we think we should do what we can to help Taiwan defend itself. But it's in some ways the most dangerous flashpoint in the whole world. And in a way, the lesson of the book I have about World War I for a crisis like today is the book is really a story that demystifies the world of statecraft. It's like, here is how to avoid a war. This is a war people regard as sort of donkeys leading heroes. It just goes on and ceaseless stalemate. And the surprising thing that they'll learn is that halfway through the war, all the major leaders made a real effort to end it and came amazingly close to doing that. And so one of the lessons for now is to notice that actually you can unwind these things. They came amazingly close to ending World War I at the midway point, before American intervention, before the Russian Revolution and the Bolshevik takeover and the Russian Civil War, before all of those things, and could have changed the whole course of world history, and it came tantalizingly close. And the book shows people and unpacks, here's how these things can be unwound. They don't have to be inevitable and inexorable.
And as the German ambassador to the United States said, peace is on the floor. You only have to pick it up. Let me again remind the audience I'm speaking with Philip Zelikow, the White Birkett Miller Professor of History and the J. Wilson Newman Professor of Governance at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, a former career diplomat. He was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, and he worked on international policy in each of the five administrations from Reagan through Obama, and is the author of the new book just out, The Road Less Traveled, The Secret Battle to End the Great War, 1916 to 1917. Of course, the title comes from Robert Frost, whose friend, the British essayist Edward Thomas, was vacillating over whether or not to come to the United States, which was a neutral country, or to volunteer for military service in World War I. The road not taken, two roads diverge in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And of course, the tragedy was that Thomas, no sooner had he arrived in France, he wrote to his wife about watching a beautiful French village being turned into rubble by an artillery barrage. A shell landed almost at his feet. It mercifully didn't go off, but then the next day he died. And of course, millions of others died in equally fruitless ways. So tell us about how this process began. Who made the initial entreaty, if you will?
The British came very close to moving for American mediation in the spring of 1916, and then barely held off for reasons I recount. Therefore, the concrete big first move to seek a mediated peace actually came from the Germans. It came from the top of the German government, approved by the Kaiser, very secretly. In August 1916. So this is a month after the Somme offensive has disastrously failed. This is during the year of Verdun. August 1916, the Germans are trying to bring the war to an end and are willing to make a compromise peace. In fact, they volunteered to restore Belgium without even being asked as a secret gesture to the Americans to show the Americans they were moving in good faith to negotiate a compromise peace. And the British, meanwhile, were tormented with secret debates about whether they could continue the war and how to end it. The Americans were eager to mediate an end to the war. They were still neutral. They had complete financial leverage over the Allied side. And what ensues is just this astonishing story in which actually a lot of the leaders tried very hard and came very close. And in the end, in some respects, President Wilson just didn't know how to do it. his strategic insight at a high level was actually remarkable and commendable. He just didn't have the operational craft to know how to construct the peace move correctly, and was there and was manipulated and very poorly served by his close advisor, Edward House. And all of this interacted with the personal ambitions of the British politician who became Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, who frustrated a timely British peace move to meet the Germans halfway. The British had learned of the secret German peace move through their intelligence services.
Which is also where the Zimmermann telegram emerged, right?
But no, the Zimmermann telegram would later emerge through the same kind of interception of German diplomatic messages. You're right. The Zimmermann telegram episode is kind of the sequel to the story I tell. After America broke off relations, the British leaked the famous Zimmermann telegram. But even though the Germans were secretly working with the Americans to get a peace mediation and a compromise peace, that secret was known to the British because they had intercepted those telegrams too.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Edward House, because he wasn't a government employee. He was a wealthy dilettante from Texas, and he was out of his depth. I don't know. I'm reminded of Reagan's kitchen cabinet or some of Trump's cronies, but how would you place him in the historical context?
Your pithy summary is all too true. I think people who go through the book will be astonished by House. They will be amazed first that he was able to be in such a unique position of trust, and then they will be astonished at how he misused and abused that position. They will be surprised by the cosmopolitan veneer of wisdom and knowledge that actually concealed deep amateurishness and dissembling. And this had enormous, enormous consequences. Sometimes I think there will be people who read this book that will try to find House's gravesite and dig him up. I think that and Lloyd George's plaque in Westminster Abbey are both in jeopardy.
Well, Wilson was obviously serious about peace without victors.
He was very serious about it, and it's part of the tragedy, actually. Right. It's not that the positions of the sides were just basically irreconcilable. They actually were reconcilable, and Wilson actually had the broad strategic vision to see it. He was, as you say, he was in favor of a peace without victory. And indeed feared that if you had a peace where one side gained a decisive victory and the other side was embittered and resentful, that any such peace would not last. And he said that. And the large level, actually, in some ways, readers will come away from this with a very mixed view of Wilson. They'll admire him in many ways, and then they'll despair for him in others.
Well, obviously, the book opens up speculation about, you know, would the Russian Revolution have happened? Would we have had Hitler? But
yeah, there's no doubt in my mind, actually, and I think all historians would agree, the Tsar may well have been overthrown, but if the war does not continue, there's no chance for the Bolsheviks to take over. The Bolsheviks would not have gained power later in the Russian Revolution if Russia had not still been in the war. That's the universal view among historians. Sure. Who've looked at that.
Right, and the Germans, of course, put Lenin in a boxcar and sent him to Russia. So the part of the tragedy with Wilson, of course, was that he had the leverage to do it. He had just won a second term, and the U.S. was loaning the Allies money to the point where the Brits were about to run out of, they had about 3 weeks left of dollar reserves.
That's right.
But tell me, though, was there any pressure on Wilson from, for the want of a better description, from Wall Street? Because without being conspiratorial, if the Brits and the French owe you so much money, you don't want the Germans to win, do you? Because then you'll not get paid back.
No, this was a wide, this is widely suspected, but in fact, if anything, the opposite is true. First, at this point, Wilson in November of 1916, very secretly got the Federal Reserve Board to say no unsecured loans, which effectively cut off continued loans to the Allied side. So all the previous loans were backed by hard collateral, gold and marketable securities. So it's not as if the Allies hadn't paid back those loans that they weren't already covered by the hard collateral that had been physically deposited in New York. So that's A. And then B is, in fact, Wall Street was furious at Wilson's move to do this. That is, in particular, J.P. Morgan and Company was furious and was throwing up their hands in despair that there was nothing they could do about Wilson. So when you actually get into the details of how Wilson handled this, Wilson pulled the plug on financing the Allies on their continued flow of dollars. And he pulled the plug in November 1916, and Wall Street could do nothing to stop it. And the only thing that saved the Allies from dollar bankruptcy was because the United States entered the war and then realized that they had to subsidize the Allies to keep from losing the war. So the only reason that they were able to get the restoration of funds was because the peace talks failed. And the peace talks didn't fail because of anything Wall Street did. The peace talks failed, frankly, because Wilson kind of blew it. And for reasons that, to the end of his life, he never quite understood. He never quite understood just what he had done wrong. And I think every reader of this book will see multiple opportunities to have gotten this right, even down to the day before America broke international diplomatic relations with Germany, when the Germans were confiding in Wilson and giving him the secret peace terms he had asked them to share.
Well, speaking of breaking diplomatic relations, of course, the idea that the German militarists, the Prussians, wanted to resume submarine warfare, and they dismissed the United States in the way that Hitler did in World War II after Pearl Harbor. Yes. After all, it was Germany that declared war on the United States. Winston Churchill said that was the best sleep he ever had, was in response to that.
In 1941, blessing. In the Second War.
Yeah, it's in 1941, of course, Pearl Harbor, yeah. But because it's not entirely clear that the United States would have gone to war against Japan, but not necessarily against Germany. So the point I'm making is that Hitler had contempt for the Americans and thought they were a joke.
And so did the German military in this period, too.
Right, that's the point I was making, that which, you make in the book. And I think Churchill said...
The military did, but the military was trying to... the military was held the United States power in contempt, but the civilian side of the German government did not. They feared exactly what turned out to be the case.
And Churchill had something to say about that, did he not? About what happened with the German military in World War One in their blindness about America.
Yes, I think he said that practically in the entire annals of human history, there's seldom been recorded a greater blunder than this German military underestimation of the United States, of the power of the American Union.
So this book that you've just done, which opens up a whole chapter of what could have been in terms of diplomacy, and as we mentioned earlier, the German ambassador said in November 1916, peace is on the floor, waiting to be picked up. And of course, the character that we mentioned earlier, the private envoy, friend of Wilson's, Edward House, what a disaster he was. How do you see our diplomatic corps? Because, you know, it's been hollowed out by the first Secretary of State under Trump, and then certainly by the last one. So where do we stand, do you think, in terms of, do you believe that had professionals in the State Department been involved in these negotiations, they would have been more successful back in 1916-17?
Yes, I do, actually. If he had relied, and I can even name a couple of professionals Wilson could have leaned on, one in London, one in Berlin, William Buckler in London and Joseph Grew in Berlin, who were offering and could have offered outstanding advice to help him. And so one of the lessons from that is the failure to lean on the expert advice that's available to you was, in this case, unbelievably tragic. But you're also right to draw that point forward to the present. In general, when people talk about diplomacy, mostly people nod their heads and say diplomacy is good, but diplomacy is one of those words that get people's eyes to glaze over. And if you just think about it, are there ways to solve problems peacefully? Are there ways to solve problems without blowing stuff up? I used to be a career diplomat myself, and I had the good fortune to be involved in some pretty big problem solving, including the peaceful unification of Germany. In other words, peaceful problem solving can work, but you have to enable and empower professionals to work on it. You have to study that and pay attention to it. And in a way, we've become a country that all too often has come to militarize its problems because of all of our major instruments are increasingly military, and we think of things and teach things that way without doing enough to study how to solve problems peacefully. And really, the book that I wrote was an effort to introduce people to one of the most colossal examples of peaceful problem solving the whole historical record can yield to us.
Well, Philip Zelikow, I thank you for your book, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Philip Zelikow, who is the White Birkett Miller Professor of History and the J. Wilson Newman Professor of Governance at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. A former career diplomat, he was the Executive Director of the 9/11 Commission, and he worked on international policy in each of the five administrations from Reagan through Obama, and is the author of the new book just out, The Road Less Traveled, The Secret Battle to End the Great War, 1916 to 1917. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how Joe Biden can quickly phase out coal-fired plants and work with key senators in coal country like Joe Manchin.
Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war. We expected something, something better than before. We expected something more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Bell, a former chair of the Finance and Business Management Department at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York. He's the author of The Green Bubble and Impure Science, and he has an article at Le Monde, Joe Biden's 100 Days, How Big Will the Energy Transformation Policy Be? And he joins us from Paris, France. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Bell.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us, Robert. And Joe Manchin is very much the key to whether or not Biden is going to have a successful presidency. He's the Democratic senator from West Virginia. Yeah. Famously, when he ran last time, he put the Green New Deal on a target and blasted it away with a shotgun. And that was his campaign commercial.
Yeah, hitting two objectives at the same time.
Right. But so, unless Biden can win him over, and in turn, Manchin can win over a couple of Republicans, Lisa Murkowski perhaps, Susan Collins, to join in what he wants to do as a bipartisan way to get rid of the filibuster and allow HR1 and SB1 to pass, then the Republicans are going to permanently going to cripple American democracy and make us more authoritarian in this power grab they have underway to rig the next elections. So a lot's at stake. So if you were trying to win over Joe Manchin, make the arguments that you do in your article about how you can basically make the argument that properly applied regulatory pressure could hasten the end of coal-fired power plants in the United States without putting the burden on the American taxpayer.
Yeah, I don't have my article right in front of me at this second, but as I recall, it's about a quarter of all the electricity is generated by coal in the U.S. And half of that is from rate-regulated utilities. That, by the way, was a very difficult number to get. if you phone, as I did, the Energy Information Agency doesn't put that out. You can't get that from the federal government, even now. Maybe you will after a couple more months of Biden in there. But the Association of State Regulators in D.C., the lobbying organization, I thought they would have that number. No, they ran me all around the block with bad information. I finally got that number from a Sierra Club official court filing. They had computed it. So about a quarter is coal, half of that is in rate-regulated utilities. All of that means in rate-regulated utilities, they work on cost-plus contracting. Whatever their costs are, they add 9 or 10%, and that's your bill. Your piece of that is your utility bill. And they are losing money, most of them, on coal. They're actually losing money. But inertia in these utilities are just poisoning the earth. The top management, you know, they got there by being people who poison the earth. That's how they got to the job. They burned coal. They're coal people. So even though it is cheaper now, you can just go to Lazard.com and look at their levelized costs of energy, and which they update every year. It's a source everybody uses. The bank, all the investment bankers use that one. You can see that new wind installations in good places, which there are just vast numbers in the U.S., and solar installations, new ones, come in much cheaper than coal. It would, these companies would actually save money if they shut down the coal and put in wind and solar. And since they're on cost-plus contracting, they could do it. And one of them is actually doing it. The only one that's actually doing that sort of thing is NextEra, which is a big Florida utility. And a couple of the others are playing around with it a little bit. But this would be a way to have a significant, take a significant bite into this energy transformation without running it through the national treasury. So there would be no need to raise taxes. Now, these utilities, right now, they could do this relatively cheaply. The pension funds buy their bonds. You know, that if you have some kind of a pension fund, they undoubtedly have these utility bonds. They pay relatively low interest on these bonds. So it's a way of financing a big hunk of the transformation right there without a nickel going through the national treasury.
But how does that apply to West Virginia? Because Biden, in his first press conference, did talk about how he wants to bring American workers into the 21st century with new jobs, new technology, American innovation, not having the Chinese develop American designed and American intellectual property, turning it to their advantage. He mentioned, for example, good paying jobs if you capped all the thousands of wells in this country spewing methane, which is a terrible global warming gas. So just specifically how in West Virginia, which Trump won by 40 points over Biden in the last election, how do you do that? How do you get those workers and those voters for Joe Manchin to embrace these 21st century jobs?
Well, I would be the last one to tell Joe Biden, who's been a senator for 50 years, how to work the Senate. That guy knows more about the Senate than you or I will ever learn. But the traditional way to do this is with massive pork barrel in the state. It's just, it would be green pork barrel. Big contracts. So with West Virginia having lots and lots of stuff. I don't know what the wind is there, how it would work with wind turbines. I've never looked at that. But if it's halfway decent, it's hilly. So at the bottom of some or near the bottom of some of those hills, it's probably wind a lot of the time. There could be a lot of wind farms. And Biden could have a program to back up. It doesn't have to run through the Treasury. He would need some kind of loan guarantee program for utilities that utilities could use, or where people could get together and create their own wind farms, you know, towns and groups of towns, so that they would be owners of this stuff. I think there are real possibilities of selling this to West Virginia or any place else, but the trick is to bring a vast amount of money into the place that has no money coming in now. The coal is a rapidly declining industry. It will never be a big industry again. That's it. It's finished. So, and the people of West Virginia, I have no doubt, are not stupid. They must know that this is a declining industry. Why? Everybody knows it. They have to know it too. So they need to be given something tangible to substitute for that. And in that way, Manchin, who I'm sure would like to back up Biden because I think they're friends, would, you know, be enabled to vote for what you're just talking about. Now, Manchin has said he will not support an abolition of the filibuster, but maybe he would go back to what Biden talked about in his press conference, which was going back to where people actually had to speak till they ran out of breath in the filibuster, the kind
right.
of the filibuster you saw in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, you know, the Jimmy Stewart movie.
Right. Well, he did make it clear that if he could make it bipartisan, in other words, peel off Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, or Mitt Romney
yeah.
to join him in reclassifying voting as being exempt from the filibuster, that would be another way to pass SB1. But just in the last couple of minutes, I want to talk to you about the point that you make in your article about how AT&T and the phone company monopolies didn't become the new powerful companies that we have now, like Apple and Facebook and Microsoft and Google, and
yeah.
that General Motors didn't become Tesla.
Right.
So how does that apply to energy in the future?
That's why I don't think, I have a quote from an excellent journalist, John Dizzard, from the Financial Times, where he says that the old monopolies will be the energy of the future. I don't believe that for one minute. Just Google John Dizzard. He's a very interesting guy. But I don't believe that for one minute. And the reason is we've seen the evidence. All the FANGs, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Google, they were all startups with singly directed management, not these enormous conglomerates. None of them come from IBM. None of them come from General Electric. Even Amazon, it doesn't come from one of the big retail giants. These are all innovative people who started those companies. Same with Microsoft and Intel. And so I think the same thing's going to happen with energy. That company I mentioned, NextEra, the top management, I've never met them, but they claim in an article I saw that they got into wind turbines by accident. They had bought some bonds from a wind farm that defaulted, and they ended up owning the wind farm and suddenly saw that this stuff actually worked. So they went and bought some more.
Well, Robert, Fred, we've run out of time, but I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Bell, a former chair of the Finance and Business Management Department at Brooklyn College of the City University of New York and the author of The Green Bubble and Impure Science. He has an article at Le Monde, Joe Biden's 100 Days, How Big Will the Energy Transformation Policy Be? And he joined us from Paris, France. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.